All right. Now the Public Safety Finance Division will come to order. We've got only two bills on the calendar for today. Several members withdrew their bills. We will be meeting again Thursday and maybe next week for other bills. So first we'll take House File 2463, Representative Ward. And Representative Ward, I believe that your motion will be that you are recommending House File 2463 to pass to be referred to the Finance Committee with a re-referral to the Transportation Finance Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that is my motion.
Okay, very good. Representative Ward, do you want to present your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I have with me today Bill Mickelson, who will be speaking in a little bit, but let me just talk about House File 2463, or a bill that's otherwise known as Joey's Law. And I just want to talk about Joey just for a minute, if I might, Mr. Chair. Joey Jordan was a 17-year-old senior going into Pequot Lakes High School for his last year of high school when he was killed by a repeat offender in the summer before his high school senior year. The repeat offender had just been released and from a previous conviction and was driving drunk again and hit Joey head on in a game of chicken, so to speak, and killed Joey, thereby devastating Joey's family. So, Mr. Chair, for 4 years I've been trying to deal with a DUI law that would be in remembrance of Joey, but also to make our roads safer and also so that families never have to go through what Joey Jordan's family has gone through. Crow Wing County, Mr. Chair, the county that I represent, is one of the deadliest counties in the state of Minnesota for impaired driving. It was third on the list, and I just read something where it has maybe dropped a few spots or whatever, but it still is one of the deadliest counties in the state of Minnesota on impaired driving, costing the taxpayers many dollars, creating many deaths, creating many injuries to our citizens in my district and in the state of Minnesota. House File 2463, or Joey's Law, hopes to do the following things, Mr. Chair. And members, you have a significant amount of information about this bill in your packets, but like a good school teacher, listen to us first and then read later, please. So I want to just remind the committee members that, you know, this is a great, great alternative tool. This is another tool for the toolbox, members, to deal with repeat offenders. What 2463 hopes to do is to reduce recidivism, improve public safety, serve as an alternate to incarceration that reduces the number of people in local jails and state prison. It allows offenders to remain in the community with their family and friends, permits offenders to maintain employment, and saves tax dollars to our taxpayers because most monitoring costs are paid by the offenders, and because offenders are being diverted from jail and prison when and where appropriate. The 2463, members, creates a pilot program in Crow Wing County, and I have been in constant communication with my sheriff there, County Sheriff Todd Dahl, who is very excited about this program. His only reservation is, you know, the implementation costs as well as the sustainability costs. But I think Mr. Mickelson is going to address those as well. This pilot program that we hope to craft in Crow Wing County will be crafted after what's called a 24/7 sobriety program. Mr. Mickelson was very involved in South Dakota, North Dakota, Montana, the three states that are currently using this program and who have had remarkable results in their DUI rates and DWI rates in their states. Without further ado, I would like to just turn it over, Mr. Chair and members, to Bill Mickelson to talk about the 24/7 sobriety program, this award-winning program, and what it can do for the state of Minnesota and the citizens of Minnesota.
Very good. Thank you. Mr. Mickelson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Bill Mickelson. I currently am President and CEO of Mickelson Consulting Group, and what my company does is just go around the United States helping other state entities and counties develop and run their 24/7 sobriety programs. As was mentioned by Representative Ward, we were instrumental in assisting North Dakota in starting a pilot. They are now statewide through a legislative act. May 1st, we launch in Montana with a pilot program. Bills are pending in New York and California for 24/7 sobriety projects that are modeled after the South Dakota project. And so there's lots of things going on. Just to bring you up to speed, this is a court-based alcohol program. And to date in South Dakota, we've had over 13,000 people who have been placed on a twice-a-day testing program. The SCRAM bracelet, we've had almost 1,800 people placed on the program since our inception in February of 2005. We use drug patches, and we also use UA, so we're doing a fair amount of drug testing as well. Of the 13,000 people that have been placed on the program of twice-a-day testing, they show up on time, and they blow clean tests 99.6% of the time, and that's been a consistent since we got started. So people do respond to being held accountable for their actions. We've had similar results with the SCRAM bracelet and similar results with our UA testing in our drug patches. So the courts have recognized it's a viable tool, it's a valuable tool, and it gets used extensively. I know that the committee is concerned about costs, and what we're going to be proposing in the pilot in Crow Wing County is a cost-neutral pilot program. It's a defender pay model modeled after South Dakota. The companies that would be the vendors would come in, and they would choose to give the equipment to run the program to Crow Wing County. The web-based reporting software is included. All the training is included. And our objective would be to be cost-neutral and have the defendant pay all the expenses. Those price points are pretty low, and so there shouldn't be any reason why somebody couldn't participate successfully. With that overview, I'll stand by for any questions that you might have.
Representative Ward, thank you for your testimony.
Can I just add, Mr. Chair?
Absolutely.
As Mr. Mickelson pointed out, and as I said earlier, this is just another tool in the toolbox. We're not trying to replace, interlock ignition or ignition interlock, or anything else like that. This is just another tool that has been effective in other states, and it's an effective tool in other states because it gets at the behavior rather than just shuts the vehicle down. It gets at the behavior changing method of the DUI repeat offenders, but it gets at that by providing swift, certain and modest sanctions. If there's a dirty blow, that offender is immediately put in jail within 24-hour period. They need to appear before a judge who provides a sanction that is very swift, certain, and modest. And that has resulted in behavior changes significantly by the participants in this program. So I want to make that clear as well, Mr. Chair, and again, we'll stand by for any questions.
Representative Warren, I'm just uncertain how this works if Representative Bigham's bill becomes law and we have the ignition interlock device, how this works as a possible option, because in the bill it says that that this is one option, ignition interlock is one option, et cetera. So would the courts then decide, and what would happen to state law that may now require this? And I'm just trying to see how they fit together.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, as we said that we'd run it as a pilot program in Crow Wing County, so we'd have to have obviously the law enforcement and the bench come on board with this as well. Both of which I believe I've communicated with, and they are. They are agreeable to that. The ignition interlock was run as a pilot program And Representative Biggin, you're going to have to help me. I think Ramsey and Hennepin County, if I'm not mistaken, are somewhere in those two counties.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Ward, I think it also was another, a greater Minnesota county too, wasn't there? Beltrami.
Yeah.
Was the other one, so there were three. While I have the mic, Mr. Chair, I actually like this. I agree with you that I think it is a another tool in the toolbox. I think that the difference is, too, Mr. Chair, and I know I don't have to state the obvious, but I will, is that, you know, the ignition lock would shut off the car, where this would be also a probation-type situation for this tool too. So I think having more tools in the toolbox is always a good thing, as long as it doesn't mess with my bill.
And Mr. Chair, members, I'd never mess with Representative Bigham, that's for sure, Mr. Chair. But to as far as the process goes, you know, we would run it, try to run it through as a pilot program and start it as a pilot program. I don't know if that answers your question, but that's how we hope to do it.
Representative Olin. And then Liebling, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Ward, and I know Representative Big M was nice when she answered, but the blunt reality is that I think what the chairman is trying to get at is if the governor's attorney interlock ignition bill were to pass, where does it fit? Because then you're requiring everybody. There isn't really a necessary need for a pilot.
Representative Ward.
Well, I guess in Crow Wing County, and I'm not sure how they handle it in North Dakota, South Dakota, and the other states that have this. Maybe they probably didn't have ignition interlock or a bill that designated a specific. But again, I guess, you know, we would look to try to proceed with this as a separate program that includes those three, that includes SCRAM and ignition interlock.
One thing that would be different, I guess, would be that under the amended version of the Bigham bill, it's a second offense unless you blow 2.0. So you could do this on a 0.20. I'm sorry. You could use this on a first. A judge could order this on a first offense. So that would be one way that I suppose this would work. Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Ward, I thank you for bringing this. I also am intrigued by this. I think that it's such a difficult problem that we should use every tool and test out every tool we can. But I wonder if you could just kind of walk through an example of how this works. I'm just having trouble sort of picturing, you know, the typical case. If you could just sort of give me a scenario, that would be helpful. Thanks.
Mr. Mickelson.
When we started our pilot, Mr. Chairman, when we started our pilot, we concentrated on DUI seconds or greater and as a condition of bond. Well, the judges quickly found out that this was working and that it was very valuable. So on their own, they started to freelance, and before we knew it, we had a tiger by the tail. The objective is to keep people sober as a condition of bond, and then post-sentence, and then post-treatment. The treatment people are telling us that the likelihood of long-term success is greatly enhanced if they're sober before they get to treatment, during treatment, and then a period after treatment. And our sole purpose with 24/7 is to work in concert with the public and private treatment people, try to get long-term successes with these folks who have clearly demonstrated they have a drinking and driving problem. And so that's really the focus of what it is that we're, the objective is that we're trying to maintain here.
Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, that's helpful, but I'm just, if you could just, you know, give me a case scenario, you know, how this would work for somebody who gets into it. When do they get in? And
a person is booked into jail for a second offense DUI. As a condition of bond, they're released, but they need to be enrolled in a 24/7 sobriety program. They have a choice, and they'll probably have a choice like this in Minnesota, where it's either interlock or twice a day breath testing or a SCRAM bracelet. If there is clear indication that there may be a coexisting condition where they need to have some random urine testing because they're substituting alcohol for example, marijuana. We may enter that into the bond schedule as well. And then they're on 24/7 until they appear at arraignment, and then the judge will at that point determine whether or not they're going to maintain that as a condition of bond. And more than likely, they're going to have to maintain that sobriety and some sort of testing through the entire process. And then as a condition of sentence, they may be required to also be on 24 testing during that probationary period. In South Dakota, to get a work permit, you must be a participant in 24/7 sobriety program, so that we are assured that, one, you have insurance, and two, that you're not going to be driving drunk again during that period of revocation or suspension. So it's a very comprehensive program in South Dakota, and we'd like to have that same comprehensive program as part of the Crow Wing County pilot.
Thank you.
Representative Bigham.
Thank you. Just one last question. More of a, more of a comment is, obviously, unless I completely don't understand the SCRAM bracelet, and I think I do, is that, or maybe how this is set up, is that obviously the ignition lock would prohibit somebody from driving because it will shut off the car, where the SCRAM bracelet is more of a monitoring thing. It wouldn't obviously stop a car, and I think our whole point is to make sure people don't drink and drive once, you know, they've offended. However, I do think that this is an idea, and I applaud Representative Ward for bringing it forward to have the discussion. You know, in some of in my bill, there are hard revocation periods. There are periods where the department doesn't want you to have any alcohol while you're on the program. There may be a chance on a repeat offender that if it's a fourth time offender and they're not a drop for a long time, maybe this is a good thing to combine it with an ignition lock program. I mean, I just think we should have the discussion. So that's all I wanted to say.
Any other discussion? Anything else, Representative Warren?
Mr. Chair, I just want the committee to know that in Representative Hillstrom's committee, I was asked a question, how does the commissioner feel about that, feel about the program? And so I contacted the commissioner, and as the commissioner and I dialogued, we dialogued about the ignition interlock, and where this is a, would fit it with a, as a tool in the toolbox as well. And the Commissioner Campion thought that it was a worthwhile discussion, dialogue, and alternative to use with repeat offenders as well. I know Sheree Martin, and I have also Sheree Marty, have also discussed this, and we're in continued dialogue with the commissioner's department, Department of Public Safety as well, as far as using this as an alternative as well.
Very good. Then Representative Ward will renew his motion that House File 2463 be passed and referred to the Finance Committee with a re-referral to the Transportation Finance Committee. Now, you may not have to do that if indeed this is cost revenue neutral, but we'll just have that as the motion for now. Is that okay?
Yes,
okay.
Mr. Chair.
Okay. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Ward.
Thank you, Member. Thank you.
While Representative Paymar is getting organized, I will. Is there Representative Hillstrom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll move the minutes from Thursday, March 11th. And Thursday, March 4th.
And the motion will actually be as amended because there's a couple of technical words, misspellings, or word mistakes in it.
That's fine, Mr. Chair.
Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carried. Representative Paymar. Mr. Chairman, would you like to move your bill to get it before this committee?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 2965 be recommended to pass and referred to the Finance Committee. And I also have an amendment, the A4 amendment, that I would move.
Okay. Representative Paymar has moved the A4 amendment to get the bill in the shape he would like. Is there any discussion on this? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor of adding the A4 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Carried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a brief introductory remarks, and then I'd like to explain what the amendment did and sort of the process this bill has gone through. And then I would like, and then I'll have, I'd like Mr. Nobles to give a brief presentation on his findings. Many of you have heard the bill before. It's changed a bit since it was first introduced. As you know, this comes out of the scandal that happened at the Metro Gang Strike Force that came to the attention of the state of Minnesota and this legislature last year. The misconduct by some officers in the Metro Gang Strike Force and the inability of the advisory board that was governing the Strike Force to correct that misbehavior, which led, of course, to the legislative auditor's report that Mr. Nobles will talk about. It also resulted in the commissioner of the Department of Public Safety to ask Mr. Luger to also do an investigation of the workings of the Metro Gang Strike Force. So what we had, members, was not only of misconduct by some officers at the Metro Gang Strike Force, but we also had a situation where the commander, the advisory board, and the fiscal agent all seemed to not hold the officers accountable, and we had a period of time where you essentially had a rogue law enforcement entity that really was a black mark on law enforcement in the state of Minnesota. And this bill hopes to correct some of those problems. I want to make clear that I know and you know that most law enforcement officers are professional and handle their responsibilities professionally and provide public safety throughout the state of Minnesota. Similarly, I'd like to believe that all of the advisory boards that govern the multi-jurisdictional law enforcement strike forces also hold those entities accountable. So we are assuming here that the activities of the Metro Gang Strike Force were an anomaly. I hope that that's the case, that the other strike forces are acting professionally, that they're protecting public safety and not violating the people's civil rights. So this bill adds accountability. I've taken the recommendations from the Luger and Nobles report. We've had input from the Department of Public Safety, from the police, from the sheriffs, from the county attorneys, from the League of Minnesota Cities, and from citizens. So with that, before I introduce the amendment, I'd like Mr. Nobles just to give a brief explanation of some of the findings that that his office found.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Nobles, and you're no stranger to this place to start with. You may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Jim Nobles, legislative auditor for the state of Minnesota. And yes, Mr. Chairman, I think all of the members of this committee are quite familiar with our report. But I do just want to, at Representative Paymar's request, reiterate that what we found was not just the failings of individuals, but a system that really broke down. And I think that's what was most concerning, is that the problems that we found had been of long standing, and yet they had not been corrected by the people that had a responsibility to do that. Now, I think you also all understand that this has been a difficult time, but we do need to move forward because the Metro Gang Strike Force is mandated to exist in law, even though effectively it has been shut down by the action of the Commissioner of Public Safety. It still is mandated to exist in law. So I think you do need to take action this legislative session. I don't think anyone is particularly interested in reviving that particular organization or ones like it without substantial change. And that's what Representative Paymar's bill is attempting to do, to give greater clarity as to who is in control and command of this kind of intergovernmental organization. It also will impose greater accountability and oversight over the organization. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions if there are any.
Are there any questions for Mr. Nobles? Seeing no questions for you, thank you, Mr. Nobles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Paymar, you can continue.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to walk you quickly through the bill. I know this is the Finance Committee, and this has gone through two committees already, so you've heard the policy implications of it. But in trying to find consensus and work with all of the stakeholders, we worked with the Department of Public Safety, who wanted the name of this entity to really change to the Violent Crime Coordinating Council, and also to include some other activities that the council would focus on, as well as the actual law enforcement entities working under the coordinating council, and that is to include other violent crimes associated with gang activity. So we're not limiting it to just drug offenses, but also looking at what gangs are being involved in the state of Minnesota, which includes human trafficking, et cetera, et cetera. So we wanted to we put that language in there. There was concern that the department had about the size, the composition of the past council, so we've reduced that from 32 to 17. Part of the amendment was at the request of the Police and Chiefs Association, I believe, and the Sheriff's Association, that wanted to make sure that Minneapolis and St. Paul were represented, as well as the sheriffs in Hennepin and Ramsey County, which we included in page one of the amendment. Just going to highlight a couple of things. The coordinating council's duties are basically the same as what was in current law. We made a few changes here, the big change, members, to be frank with you, is really the duties and the authority of the commissioner. For those of you who were at some of the hearings we had over the summer, I think it was very clear that we had a problem. The commissioner knew there was a problem, and really there was nothing we could do about it. So the commissioner, the only thing that he had, the only option he had, was to cut off their funding. But the advisory board continued to exist, Metro Gang Strike Force continued to exist, and it still continues to exist, much to my chagrin, but it's there. So this is a way for us to say that if this does happen in the future, and I don't know if it will, I'm hoping that I think a lot of lessons were learned, but this provides some safeguards, some accountability. So if the commissioner under this bill would have to certify the multi-jurisdictional entities and their designated fiscal agents, so that the commissioner would design a certification process, and if during audits or during investigations or grant applications it was determined that there were any problems going on with any of these gang strike forces, the commissioner could close them down. So that's the biggest part of what this bill does. It also, and I took this, and we have some work to do because in the fiscal note there was a cost to the Department of Public Safety, which could probably be absorbed by the current grant money that the legislature provides. But I also was talking with Mr. Nobles about whether it's necessary to do an annual audit or if we could do this biannually. So I think we could probably end up with this bill either being cost neutral, and I need to work with DPS as this bill goes to the Finance Committee relative to that requirement. Other than that, we had some language that was recommended by, I'm not sure if it was Mr. Nobles or Mr. Luger, about having the prosecutor be more involved in training, and we changed some language here that satisfied the County Attorneys Association. There was one big sticking point that you will see on page 5 of the bill, section 2. This essentially dissolved the Metro Gang Strike Force. I still believe that we should do this, but rather than have a potential legal battle or have with the League of Minnesota Cities, we've decided to strike this language. They were concerned that if this language existed, that they would not be able to resolve some of the outstanding claims against the Metro Gang Strike Force. As you know, there's several outstanding lawsuits against the Strike Force. And obviously, we don't want the state to be liable for any of these costs. I think Ms. Perius had drafted the bill in such a way that protected the state, but in order to move the bill along and to get everyone's agreement, we will strike Section 2 from the bill. Everything else, I believe, is either just minor adjustments to the bill or current law. So I'd stand for any questions.
Are there any questions for Representative Paymar? Representative Biggin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Paymar. Refresh my memory again. I know that over the summer, as you said, the commissioner, the only thing he could do was withhold the funds from them. Where are the funds now, and what are they going for? Are they just sitting in the same old pot of money and just unallocated? Because I think we're the ones that have to allocate it. But do you know, have you been updated by staff on where it is?
Representative Paymar or Mr. Nobles?
Mr. Chairman, members, the money is in a bank account under the control of the Gang Strike Force. It is there to try and settle the outstanding claims. There is also a payment that needs to be made to the Attorney General. As you recall, one of our findings was that the payment from the forfeited funds had not been made to the Attorney General as it should have been under law. So that is being negotiated between the Gang Strike Force and the Attorney General's office. So I think that, again, this is the need for some continuation of the legal entity so that it can settle all of these various issues.
And, Mr. Chair, Representative Biggum, the League was okay with an effective date that would dissolve the strike force. They could get all their business fund done by December 31st, 2010.
Are there any other questions? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Paymar, I had understood that one of the problems with the task force's general and with the supervision is that given the nature of these task forces, you're taking officers from various law enforcement agencies who are essentially have supervision within their own agency and would normally have a process of supervision and review of their performance through their own home agency, and then you're putting them in the task force where they're under the control of a task force, I don't know if the terminology is the commander, but somebody who's not responsible for their normal evaluation process and normal supervision process, and that structure in itself can cause some problems. And I know the bill doesn't specifically address that, but I guess I'd like to know if you think that the bill is really sufficient to deal with that problem, or if maybe if you feel that that isn't the major problem, that the problems that you are dealing with in the bill, the Oversight Council and so on, is the more pressing and immediate need here.
Mr. Chair, let me just take a crack at it and then have Mr. Nobles. I would turn your attention to page 4, subdivision 6, and that does deal with the that participating officers will be subject to annual performance review conducted by the entity's operational supervisor, which is what we the language that we put in there. And I would also add that I think that under our bill here, that the commissioner will have much more oversight in evaluating how the multi-jurisdictional entities are functioning in the past. But I think that was a legitimate issue that Mr. Nobles and Mr. Luger found about a sort of a standalone agency that weren't accountable to a larger police department. But Mr. Nobles, what?
Mr. Nobles.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, I think you point to one of the most significant problems that we found. It was a breakdown in control and command, a very concerning situation for a police entity. And I think we saw that most graphically when we were there, when there was a new commander who came in from Hennepin County Sheriff's Office and tried to assert his control over the Metro Gang Strike Force and address some of the issues, as I said, that were known by others and were being pointed out by us. And he essentially found that extremely difficult to the point that the Hennepin County Sheriff effectively withdrew him from that assignment because he simply could not assert his control over that multi-jurisdictional organization. I do think this bill attempts to address that by the point that Representative Paymar referred to, but I would also refer you to under the duties of the Commissioner of Public Safety and the guidelines that he is to establish that would be required as the criteria by which one of these multi-jurisdictional organizations would be certified. And the first of those is that the multi-jurisdictional entity will be subject to the operational command and supervision of one of the participating agencies. And I don't think that was clear at the Metro Gang Strike Force. Even though a commander and the fiscal agent came from one of the participating agency, the actual authority of that commander and that participating agency, I think, was quite unclear. So I do think that there are attempts to do that. Obviously, whatever you put into the law will ultimately, or the test of whether or not this is an effective provision is whether or not people follow it. And we will not know that until this actually becomes operational.
Okay, thank you.
Any follow-ups, Representative Lieberman?
No, that's fine. Thank you.
Are there any other questions at this stage?
Mr. Chair, there may be some testimony.
Oh, I see Mr. Franklin is here. I assume that he wants to testify somewhat. Mr. Franklin, you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jim Franklin, Minnesota Sheriff's Association, this morning speaking on behalf of the Chiefs and the MPPOA, and I believe the county attorneys also. This has been a very difficult process, and I want to just thank Representative Paymar and specifically his staff who have worked diligently with us to try to address the various concerns, come up with the right wording. I won't highlight all of the issues that you're well familiar with. This bill goes a long ways to trying to solve those issues. And I would just simply say, this is, and I think somebody mentioned it, about the future. This is the first step of a new day to go back and rebuild the trust that has been lost by the damage that has been done. And there's a lot of work here to be done. And this is just a first step, and we look forward to the continuation of this dialogue. We have a long ways to go, and I think we're up for the challenge. We look forward to working with each of you, specifically Representative Paymar, as we approach this topic and move well beyond this onto some other areas that we think also needs attention. So with that, I'll conclude my remarks.
Are there any questions of Mr. Franklin? Thank you, Mr. Franklin. Are there any other persons in the public that desire to speak on this issue, on this bill? Sir?
May I approach?
Yeah, please do. Take a seat and state your name and proceed.
My name is Melvin W. Carter. I'm a retired St. Paul police officer, and I have a bunch of years on patrol, internal affairs, and detective, and I hope that I bring a balance to this. I can tell you that the main tool that law enforcement has, above all, is trust in the community, above everything else. And I felt personally betrayed by some of the things that seem to have happened with the street gang task force. And I don't know where we're going from here, but we've got a lot of credibility to rebuild in that capacity. And I'm thinking that whichever jurisdiction is appointed ahead of this, of wherever we go with this, I'm hoping that it be very much a policy where people will select and come in and appoint that position rather than just arbitrarily being selective. And also, you know, I served almost 30 years, and this is a subject that's dear to my heart. You know, people have come to me and complained about what the allegations were against law enforcement. I haven't spent, you know, 3.5 years in St. Paul Police Internal Affairs Division, you know, I would always presume, okay, well, you must have done something. You know, these guys would not just arbitrarily select you out of the clear blue sky and do some of these things that people are saying are being done. And when I looked and seen that there must be something to these allegations, you know, and I'm trusting the process, and I'm not condemning, but I think that we need to address the issue of rebuilding credibility with law enforcement, between law enforcement and the people that we serve. And I think that the system needs to be monitored on some kind of basis. And I don't know what that is, but I want to commend Mr. Paymar for his efforts and all the people that are working through this, and I just trust you all to make the good comprehensive decision. Thank you.
Does anybody have any questions for Mr. Carter? Thank you for your testimony. Are there any other persons in the audience desiring to be heard on this bill?
Chairman, I also might add one thing I neglected to say. There was another provision of the bill that was dropped because we didn't feel we could work it out, which is all the database issue, and you might have been reading about this. And we're near agreement on how to deal with some of the database issues, whether it's the pointer file or GangNet and parental notification. We're very close to it. It's not, we won't be able to do it because of bill deadlines, but a lot of the Minneapolis and St. Paul gang units, as well as the St. Paul NAACP, we've been meeting for several weeks, and we've really made a lot of progress because, you know, there's one thing. It's one thing to have law enforcement to do their job and give them the tools to do their job to combat gang activity, but it's another thing when you have poor neighborhoods, often communities of color, where a lot of this gang activity is and where most of the victims are. And those communities want a voice in how this all happens, and they want to try to prevent young people from joining gangs. So we're trying to do this in a more holistic manner. So that's one provision that hopefully we'll be able to have ready either this year or next year that I think will also help this matter. But I really appreciate all the work and all of the stakeholders to make this bill a reality, and appreciate your support.
Are there any questions or comments by the committee, any of the committee members before Representative Severson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chair Paymar, I appreciate all the work that you've done on this. I think it's been a trying task. As I've attended some of the committees, and there's been some confrontation, obviously, but there's been good work done here. But I was wondering, there's on line 6.1, it's got a blank in the fiscal note appropriation. Is there a fiscal note, and is that going to be able to be used by some of the burn grants and some of the things we get from the federal side? Or
Mr. Chair, maybe Mr. Carter can also address this, but we could do this one or two ways. I can make some changes in the bill between at Finance Committee that would limit the amount of audits that take place, which I understand is probably the more costly part of it, or we could simply have that absorbed in the overall appropriation in grant money that we make to all of the strike forces. It's a nominal amount of money. But Mr. Carter, do you have any? I don't know if you have anything to say about it.
Mr. Carter.
Yeah. Mr. Chair and representatives, basically the fiscal note says that the audit function will require an amount about $95,000 a year, and basically they will be taking that out of existing grant funds. And they're saying that's for, you know, about 1,000 hours at $85 an hour and some travel and lodging expenses.
And Mr. Chair, in talking to Mr. Nobles, he didn't think that it was absolutely imperative to have an annual audit. So if we did this biannual, I'm sure we could save some money. And I'm happy to work with the department to get those numbers down, to get more money out into the communities.
Representative Severson, do you have any follow-up on that?
No. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was great.
Are there any other questions? Representative Lieberman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's more in the nature of a comment. I just wanted to say something after Mr. Carter, was it?
Carter.
Ted, you don't need to come back to the table, but I just wanted to, first of all, thank you for coming. And I'm very struck by what you said, that how important it is, the trust between the community and law enforcement. And, of course, that's really the crux of what Representative Paymar is trying to do here, is restore that trust. And I just I really appreciate your coming here as a retired police officer and one with the experience that you have to remind us of that, because, you know, it's so important, especially in these times of declining budgets, but at any time, because if we don't have that trust, we can't have enough law enforcement to keep order. There is a real social contract, and a lot of that is that people have to believe that the police are acting fairly and under proper controls, and that they're correctly motivated, that the law is enforced fairly. And so I really appreciate that. I just wanted to say that and to thank Representative Paymar for bringing this bill.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Are there any other committee members wishing to be heard? Seeing none, would you like to renew your motion?
Mr. Chair, I would renew my motion that House File 2965 as amended be passed and referred to the Finance Committee.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Carried. The last thing before we officially adjourn, I'm going to call on the Chairman to indicate if he has any announcements he'd wish to make while I'm up here.
Mr. Chairman, except that we have several bills on the agenda for Thursday.
Okay. And with that, I will adjourn the meeting.